We're working our way through the book of James and a series that I entitled, Can You See Him? And if you look on the back of your bulletin, I have a very simple four-point outline that is taken from James 5, 17 through 12, and it's titled The Practice of Patience in Suffering. And I think being patient with people is something that not only James would encourage us to do, but Jesus would too. So as we look at that, what are some of the things that you practice in life? What are some of the things that you practice? As they were teasing Don about taking his toothbrush, I still practice that, brushing my teeth a couple times a day. I don't claim to have figured it out yet. I do have one of the new ones that has a battery in it, and if I'm smart enough to push the button, it's less work for me. And I think it does a better job, but I don't know. I'm still practicing. I still have the general tendency of function that even when I turn the battery on, I want to make all the strokes for myself rather than just letting it do the work. Any of the rest of you, doesn't it seem awkward in our country that you have to have a battery-assisted toothbrush? It's like it's so much work, right? What are some of the other things that you practice on a regular basis? Cell phones. Cell phones are... It doesn't seem that long ago that there was no such thing, right? You may not be able to remember, but I can remember seeing my first portable phone. And when we got one, it was a big bag thing with a regular handset. And we thought that was so cool. I mean, it took up a whole seat in the front seat of the station wagon. But we'd have that house phone in the car. And we thought it was so cool that when we'd get out at the baseball games, we'd carry it with us and set it next to our lawn chair, you know, in case the phone rang. Well, no one knew our number, you know. But do you remember? I'm like Clarence. I'm still practicing with the goofy thing. I put somebody's number in there the other day and forgot to hit the one button to save it. I had to enter it all over again. Actually, rather... Then being patient, I handed it to Jules, and I said, would you do that for me? I'm still practicing at cell phones. What are some of the other things you're practicing? Nothing? Jump. Working on your jump shot. There you go. Yeah. Practicing a back bend. I could practice one and then that'd be it. We'd be laid up. Twice a day. My granddaughter is in tumbling, and you know what she practices? Ta-da! I'm always asking her when she flips off of the trapeze after skinning the cat or the dog or the cow, whoever she was skinning on the trapeze. I said, you forgot your ta-da, but you got to hold your fingers in just the right way when you do the ta-da. So she practices that. Yes. Did you have one? Ta-da. He's practicing at losing weight. Oh, there you go. I'm practicing at gaining weight. No, but, you know, there are things like that. It's probably a new bow. Yeah. Yeah, my son was on the front porch the other day, and he's looking forward to fall so that he can do the things that he loves to do, watch bears and play football and kill deer and, you know. But Yeah, but you do have to practice to be good at it. Yes, sir. Practicing baseball. That's good. Baseball practice. There are a number of young men in our community that Tuesday will start two-a-days. Two-a-days are football practice. You can't officially start yet. The coaches won't be there. But they will start practicing two times a day to get in shape for football. So there's a lot of things that we practice in life. Now, how much of your day or your week would you say is done with patience? Is a lot of your life patient, or are there segments of time when you're not very patient? Some people might say you're impatient. You don't like to wait. When I've been spending a lot of time in medical communities over the last few years, and you have to practice being a patient. I mean, they're in a medical practice, and you practice patience because you spend a significant amount of time waiting in the waiting room and a significant amount of time laboring with the rigmarole of what goes on in the medical community. So patience is something that you need in that. And do you enjoy living and working with people that are patient with you? How many of you like that? You have somebody that's patient with you and encouraging and kind, and they don't grumble and they don't complain and they don't blame you when things go wrong, but they encourage you, and they're patient and uplifting and helpful. Those are nice people to work with and live with, aren't they? And I think that's what James is saying to us. Can you see him? How has Jesus been patient with you this week? Every day. Every day I think that there are things in my life that he has to be patient with me because I haven't got them all worked out and I'm not to the place where I think I want to be and I think he wants me to be. So I think he's quite patient with me. If I were God, a lot of us would be like those bugs on my windshields. You know, I wouldn't be patient at all. But God is very patient, and I'm thankful for that. Here's what it says in James chapter 5, beginning at verse 7. Be patient then, brothers, until the Lord's coming. See how the farmer waits for the land to yield its valuable crop and how patient he is for the autumn and spring rains. You too be patient and stand firm because the Lord's coming is near. Don't grumble against each other, brothers, or you will be judged. The judge is standing at the door. Brothers, as an example of patience in the face of suffering, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. As you know, we consider blessed those who persevered. You have heard of Job's perseverance and have seen what the Lord finally brought about. The Lord is full of compassion and mercy. Above all, brothers, do not swear. Not by heaven or by earth or by anything else. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. You will be condemned. So our outline on the back of your bulletin is be patient until the Lord's coming. Don't grumble against each other. An example or two of patience. And then do not swear. And I left you enough room that if there's anything on here that speaks to you, you could make note of that and write it on your bulletin. So our first section comes from James 5:7. It says, be patient then, brothers, until the Lord's coming. See how the farmers wait for the land to yield the valuable crops. How patient he is for the autumn and spring rains. You too be patient. Stand firm because the Lord's coming is near. That second line, be patient and stand firm, really summarizes what God wants us to do here. So be impatient until the Lord's coming. If you were to think about the Lord's coming, how would you describe your waiting? As patient or complacent? How many patient people we got? How many complacent people you got? I think there's a lot of us that if we were honest, we don't really spend any mental, spiritual, psychological, practical time thinking that the Lord's coming soon. When he left 2010 years ago, he said he was coming back soon. And it's got to be getting close, I would think. You know, I tend to think, well, soon by your soon and soon by my soon, Lord, are not the same. But then, you know, he lives in eternity. I mean, where there's forever and ever and ever and ever. And so, you know, a couple thousand years is just like a day or so up there. But I think that each one of us could work on our present state of mind to be more patient and thinking of it. So can you see him? He is coming back soon. He is. He's coming back. So when do you expect him? Do you have an idea when he's coming? Now he says no one really knows. Somebody handed me this flyer this week. The end of the world is almost here. Holy God will bring Judgment Day on May 21 of 2011. And they have a really nice biblical presentation. A lot of scripture verses, why they say it's that day. And I read through it. I don't know if they're right or not. But he is coming back soon. I don't know if it's that day or not. You've probably heard my theory on this, that he will come back by the Jewish holidays. That the last holiday that he fulfilled was Pentecost, when he sent the Holy Spirit to visit each one of our lives. And the next holiday that needs to be completed is the Feast of Trumpets. And you've heard probably in Revelations that the trumpet sounds and he comes in the east in the afternoon and lights up the sky like the greatest sunrise you've ever seen, although it's the sun setting in the west and he'll come in the east some afternoon. And I think it's on the Feast of Trumpets is when I think he comes back. He'll come back to fulfill that holiday, and then after the Feast of Trumpets, then he'll fulfill the rest of the feasts, and the, you know, the Feast of Tabernacles is a 1,000-year millennium reign that he lives here. But I think he'll come back by his promise to the Jews. So does James use an illustration here that we in Cornfield County can understand? Yeah. Can a farmer hurry the process of the crops growing? Does it help him any to go out there and stand and cheer for the corn? Not really. Can we hurry Jesus coming back? No. Do farmers get to take the summer off while they wait for the harvest to be ready? It'd be like Doris, just hang a little nap, yes. They got the corn in the ground. Okay, put your feet up, relax. Go to Mexico for a couple months and come back and harvest. Is that the way it works? No, there's a lot of work to be done to get a good harvest, isn't there? And a farmer needs to be in his field regularly to be checking to see if the Japanese beetles are out there. Japanese beetles are tearing up the beans behind the church. I mean, it looks like somebody's been out there with a shotgun just blasting them. And the farmer needs to be in his field to check those sort of things and deal with those events. Needs to cultivate it, needs to weed it. On this day and age, they round up it. But you need to fight the insects. There's a lot of work to be done. So how could we relate that farming illustration to us? In much the same way, we wait patiently for Jesus' return, don't we? Can we make him come any sooner? No. But while we wait, is there much we could be doing to ensure a good harvest? Yeah, see, we are like farmers. We're supposed to be involved in producing this great harvest. And Jesus used all the time farming illustrations to explain to people what is going to happen and that you need to be working the fields. So do farmers and Christians both live by faith? When I was young and was working on a farm, I'd never really thought about it, but I came to the understanding that farming is really high-stakes gambling. You take all the money you have and you put that into seed and put it into the field and fertilizer and machinery in the hope you're betting that you're going to make a profit. But it's really high-stakes gambling. You're betting everything, a lot of farmers are in this day and age, on the crop that's coming in. And the rates of sale per bushel and so forth are right. Well, I read online the other day that Bill Cosby's running for the presidency, and one of the things that he was going to do is he was going to sell grain nationally and internationally, and the price of a bushel of grain would be the same as a barrel of oil. Whatever the oil price is, that's what a bushel of grain is worth. So if you want us to buy your oil and you want to buy our food, it's an even trade. And I thought, well, that'd be really cool. And the farmers would probably really like that, wouldn't they? But, see, they live by faith, hoping that the market's going to hold. So are they looking forward to a future reward for their labors? Yeah, and patiently, anxiously waiting for that. Are you living your life like Christ will not come back? Or not too soon? Do you actually live your life like he's not coming back? Or if he is, I got time to get my act together before he gets here? James and I are encouraging you to get your life together, get your act together now, because you don't know exactly when he's coming back. The people who wrote that pamphlet got that date. I got my idea. But he said nobody really except the Father knows. So, should we be working faithfully to build the kingdom? This is yes. When you nod your head like that. We really, all of us, should be doing that. The king will come back when the time is right. Are you ready? Are you standing firm? Are you in position and standing firm and working towards that patiently? So in James 5:9 it says, don't grumble against each other, brothers, or you will be judged. The judge is standing at the door. So when we look at the second point on the outline is don't grumble and judge each other. So we looked at our relationship with Jesus. Now should we take a look at our relationship with each other? I think so. When things go wrong, do you tend to grumble and blame others for your miseries? Do you tend to do that? Last Sunday night, Julie was explaining to me that sometimes I get into a habit of grumbling and blaming other people. And she says, it's not very fun living with you when you are like that. But I do that. I sin and I get into that pattern. And I'm very thankful to have people around me to help me notice what I'm doing. Can anybody remember what it says in Genesis 3:11-13? In the beginning of the Bible, the third chapter, the Lord said, who told you you were naked? Have you eaten from the tree I commanded you not to eat from? The man said, the woman you put with me, she gave me the fruit and I ate it. And the Lord said to the woman, honey, what is this you've done? Woman said, well, the serpent deceived me and I ate. Brothers and sisters, this was the first Independence Day. They'd abandoned a totally dependent lifestyle on God for the freedom, the independence, to know what was good, what was evil, what was right, what was wrong. That was the first Independence Day. And because of their choices, all of us live in a world of sin this day. And that blame game started there. So anytime sin is present in your life, the general tendency is for you to blame somebody else. And if you really think about it, what Adam was saying to God was something like this: God, my life and my relationship with you was really great until you brought this naked woman into my life. And it's your fault, because everything was good until you gave me her, and now it's all a mess because of what you did. If you wouldn't give me the woman, we'd still be cool. The general tendency is for you and I to do the same thing today. We're going to blame God. We're going to blame somebody else. And we'll grumble. So, God asked Adam about his sin. Adam blamed Eve. Eve blamed the serpent. So if you honestly ask yourself, are we much different today? Do we do much different? Not really. Can you see him? What else then could one do if sin is present? Well, possibly we could admit we were wrong. I often wonder if God would have asked Adam and he said, you know what, sir? The lady was deceived by the serpent. Let the girl off. Let the girl go. I knew what I was doing and I rebelled against you. Just let me take the blame. Let the girl off and just settle it with me. I'll take the punishment. Because that's basically what Jesus did when he came. He said, Father, I'll take the blame. Father, I'll take it. I wonder what would have happened if Adam would have done that. But he didn't. We could, though, because of the life of Jesus. Can you see him in us? We could do that. We could admit we were wrong rather than blaming somebody else or grumbling about the situation. And we could admit we had wrong attitudes and our actions were wrong. We could confess our sin. And we could seek forgiveness from God and from others. We could confess our sin to God rather than blaming and grumbling. And we could ask his forgiveness. And we could go to those people that we offended, that we grumble against and so forth. And we could ask their forgiveness too, couldn't we? That would be a better pattern than grumbling and complaining. Before we judge others for their shortcomings, should we remember that Christ, the judge, is coming soon to evaluate each one of us? Before we judge anybody else, should we remember that? It says in Matthew 25:31-34, when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, he'll sit on the throne in heavenly glory. And all the nations will be gathered before him, everybody. All the living, all the dead. And he will separate the people one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He'll put the sheep on his right and the goats on his left. Then the king will say to those on the right, come, you who are blessed by my Father, take your inheritance and the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. And verse 41 says, then he will say to those on his left, depart from me, you who are cursed, into eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. This is serious business when we grumble and judge other people. And we want to be ready, patiently waiting for the king's return. So can you see him sitting on the throne? Can you see him in your mind? Sitting on a lot of people call it the white throne judgment. He'll sit on that throne and everyone stands before him. Can you see him? He will not let us get away with shifting the blame. When you stand before him, there won't be any, well, you know, it was the woman you gave me. That's the problem. You know, if she wouldn't have, or if he wouldn't have, then I wouldn't have. No. I mean, each one of us individually will stand there. And as James says, he's standing at the door. You know, that picture on the back of the church is Jesus standing before that beautiful oak door knocking on it. He's right there. He's coming soon. James 5:10 says, brothers, as an example of patience in the faith of suffering, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. As you know, we consider blessed those who have persevered. You have heard of Job's perseverance and have seen what the Lord finally brought about. The Lord is full of compassion and mercy. It's interesting, as we've been reading through the Old Testament this week, we've been reading about Job and his friends, or so-called friends, right? And really soon we're going to get to the good part, where Job and God talked. So if you've fallen off on your daily Bible reading, I encourage you to get back, because this part of Job is a very important thing. Job is the oldest book in the Bible, older than any other book, written before any of the rest, and it has the most clear, concise spiritual picture of what goes on in heaven. As you read about the dialogue and the interaction between God and Satan, as you read about the direct interaction between God and Job, he openly expresses to you some very important things about himself and your walk with him. So, on our outline, it says, an example of patience. Did the prophets in the Old Testament have easy lives? Today, when you read Acts 12, I read my evening reading early because I wasn't sure that the fireworks wouldn't mess up my afternoon. And I read that, and I read, and Paul is laying sleeping, handcuffed to two soldiers without his clothes on and without his cloak to cover up. He's laying on a cold floor chained to somebody, and he's sleeping, and an angel comes up and kicks him in the side and wakes him up and says, get up, get dressed, put your shoes on, put your cloak on too, follow me. But the prophets spend time in prison. And James, the brother of John, was murdered by Herod Agrippa in the first part of that chapter. I mean, he chopped off his head, and the Jews were so happy that he said, well, let's kill Peter too. It's just like today, the rulers and the president looks at his public opinion poll. What are my stats? How am I doing, public opinion, right? Herod Agrippa hacked off James' head. His stats went way up. Let's kill Peter, too. And what about Job? As you read Job, he did not have an easy stroke of it, did he? He had a tough time. Did Job and his wife lose all that they had? Yeah, all the kids are gone, all the cattle, all the donkeys, all the camels, all the wealth, it's all gone. His health is gone. At sometimes when you read the interactions with him and his wife, he might have even thought, well, why didn't you take her too? How about some of these people I thought were my friends? Hey, you could have killed them too. Wouldn't have bothered me too bad, Lord. Right? He didn't have it easy. Why does God let that stuff happen to people? Was the oldest book in the Bible written so that we could watch a test of trust? Was it? Was Job given the answers to why all this was happening to him? No, he wasn't, was he? Here's what Job said in Job 23:10. He said, but he knows the way that I take. When he has tested me, I will come forth as gold. Job understood that the life of a Christian is much like the refining of gold. It's a process with heat and pressure, and it removes the impurities. And he knew that he was being tested. And what God tests in us is our dependency, our trust, our faith in him. That's the test. So is James saying to us that we must experience life as Job did? It's possible that many of the struggles that you and I go through in life are like Job, that God allows Satan to do things in our life so that we can deepen our assurance in him. So, how do we do that? We live one day at a time without complete answers to the life's questions. You just live one day at a time, trusting God, looking forward to Jesus' return, believing in him, confessing our dependency on him, continually working out this salvation that he's given us in a practical sense all the time. And you may not know why things are happening in your life. But as Job says, in the near future, even though he slays me, yet will I trust him. He's going to trust God I was talking to my son-in-law in a church they go to over in Cedar Rapids. He says, yeah, the preacher's in Daniel. He's been in Daniel forever. You know, Daniel and his friends were going to be thrown into the lion's den. And they said, well, you know, the Lord can save us from that or he can save us through that. But either way, we're going to trust him. We're not going to bend our knee to you. We're going to trust God even no matter what happens. Is that the way we're going to live? Day to day, one day at a time, one moment at a time, trust in him. Will we, like Job, trust God no matter what? Will you? I think it's something you have to work out in your mind and be prepped, be prepared for. You know, the soldiers who fought in the Independence War, or the ones that fought in the Civil War, the ones that fought in the Great Wars 1 and 2, you know, these men were all prepared for battle. And you and I need to be prepared for the conflict that's coming. Can you, like me, say, in God we trust? Have any of you been offered those new coins, those new dollar coins that don't have "in God we trust" on them? You know, my encouragement is to tell the cashier or the lady, no thank you. I would rather not receive that. There is a great movement within our country to remove from all of the scripts and the money that we have "in God we trust." But is it really in God you trust? So, do we live in a fallen world of sin? Yes, we do. Will we see injustice in our lifetime? Absolutely, you will. Does the book of Job show us a good man suffering? Absolutely. When you read the first chapters of that, Satan is saying, you know, I've been here and there, and God says, hey, let me brag on Job a little bit. Have you seen Job? That's a servant of mine. Yeah, yeah, I've seen him. He's happy and fat and sassy because God says, well, go ahead. You can do this. You can do that. God lets people be tested. And some of his most faithful ones in some of the most severe ways. If you're going to build faith like Job's, then we need a deep confidence in the truth that God's ultimate purpose will come to pass. As you read through Job, he knows that he will get justice in the end. And we need to be trusting God like that. In James 5:12, it says, above all, brothers, do not swear, not by heaven, by earth, or anything else. Let your yes be yes, and your no be no. Or you will be condemned. So our last point is, do not swear. So what would that look like in our day and age? If a person had a habit of telling lies, do we like to live and work with them? Do you like to live and work with people that you don't know if they're telling you the truth, if they're honest, and they make these exaggerated promises and they swear they'll do this and they do that and they don't? Do you like to live with those kind of people? It's not really that fun. If we avoid telling lies and half-truths and exaggerations and omissions of the truth, then we would be known as a trustworthy person. And I wrote that long question looking at my own life. I have the pattern in my life to exaggerate things, to let things off of the story to make it look better and so forth. And it's a real struggle to be totally, completely honest in recounting things. But I want to be. It's something that I need to work at, and I need James's encouragement to just say yes or no. Does that make sense? Not making it a big deal. It's just, yes, please. No, thank you. It's plenty. So our goal then is to always be honest so that people will believe our simple yes or no. That's the goal. To be honest and just say yes or no. So my last two slides are, as you enjoy freedom in this country and in God's kingdom, let's remember James's words. Okay? So we have freedom today. We're celebrating Independence Day. Remember, Christ is coming back soon. So live like that's true. Be ready. When he's going to come like a thief in the night. Be ready. Get yourself prepared. Be patient with others. Don't grumble. Don't complain. Don't judge them. Live that way this week. Day to day, be patient. And live a life that is an example of patience. Show people how to be patient by you being patient. And lastly, just say yes or no. That's enough. You don't have to exaggerate it. You don't have to make a big deal out of it. You don't have to swear by this or swear by that or promise this or promise that. Just say, yes, please. No, thank you. And let it go at that.